I was born in 1970 and I lived in Springfield and Talla since I was, I think, 1.5.
Playwright Marco Rowe is one of 4 children. He grew up in a Talla that was itself in the process of growing.
I do remember at first it was, you know, probably 40 or 50 houses surrounded by fields. And I do definitely have a recollection of those fields starting to disappear and the estate getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
The ever-expanding estate became the playground of the future playwright.
My memories of being young are, you know, I suppose the opposite of, you know, green pastures and woods and fields and stuff. It was all about scaffolding and muck and puddles. And I always remember muck was a big thing because you just didn't want to go home muck up to the eyeballs, but you always came home muck up to the eyeballs, you know, because that was where you played.
O'Rourke attended the local St Mark's primary and secondary schools and forged some colourful friendships.
I remember from those periods that I always seemed to hook up with the bad guy, the most dangerous guy in the class, you know what I mean? I don't know if that was for protection or what, but they always, you know, the toughest, baddest, kind of, in a way, coolest guy always seemed to kind of take a shine to me. So that was always who I hooked up with.
These friendships, however, didn't always inspire confidence.
I remember a sense of mistrust of everybody around you. You were constantly hanging out with guys who could kind of, who could explode kind of at any time, and who could be very unpredictable. And I remember there was one guy in particular, and we used to climb the scaffolds on the building sites, and you'd go up onto the third scaffold, which was like the height of the house, basically, of a two-story house, but you wouldn't go near him, because you were literally scared he'd push you off. So I suppose that definitely had a bearing on, I suppose, the unpredictable and more violent nature of the plays.
When not playing on the scaffolding, the future playwright found entertainment elsewhere.
I was a big film fan, and I think it happened concurrently with the invention, or the time when video players started appearing in people's houses. I would only watch the lowest common denominator stuff. So I was watching loads and loads of kung fu movies, loads and loads of horror movies, because this was kind of the age of the video nasty as well. And in fact, I say lowest common denominator, I didn't really watch comedies. It was kung fu movies and horror movies. And there was a friend of mine who I hung out with, and I'm sure lots of young guys or older guys will remember doing sort of similar things, where you'd call up to a mate's house at 11, and then after the folks went to bed, you would spend the next 5 hours watching videos, you know? And that was kind of what I did almost night after night.
There were, however, lessons being learnt.
Just watching stuff, I think, and paying attention is invaluable in learning about writing, particularly about structure, I think, because I find when you write something, if the structure is going awry, or if it's getting too slow, or if you're spending too long on something, when you read back over it, you have the instinctive memory of so many great movies to play that against. It's a great template for knowing if your work is working or not.
Schoolwork was not a major concern.
In school, I remember doing career guidance. You know, you'd have a career guidance class once a week, whatever, and they talk about the points you need for college, for certain courses and whatever. And I just never, I never saw myself going there. It just seemed like something ungraspable. It was too far away. It was too difficult. I wasn't good enough in school anyway. I knew I couldn't even approach those kind of grades. And actually, I remember being in a career guidance class, and the career guidance teacher, we were doing, not improvisations, but acting out an interview scene or whatever. So I was called up to act out mine, and I was kind of playing to my mates and making a mockery of the whole thing. And she went bananas. And she said, "I'd like to see you in 10 years and see if you're laughing." And I remember, so I would have been like 15 or 16 then. I remember I was 21, 22, working in Dunn Stores in Kilnamana in the stockroom. This particular day I was bringing hangers up in boxes and bring them up to a till. And there she was. And she just looked at me. And it was a really defining moment, you know. She got me.
The decision was made to try something new.
I started writing sketches, little pieces of dialogue, to see if I could write dialogue and stuff like that. And then I decided to write a play, purely because, once again, the idea of doing a film or having a film made was so outlandish, and the odds were so astronomically against it happening. I kind of thought if you do a play, even if a theatre company doesn't take it, you could put it on yourself maybe, or do it in the school hall or something like that. So I wrote a first play, which was The Aspidistra Code. And around that period, I heard from a sister of a friend who was in Dublin Youth Theatre at the time that there was a playwriting competition called Stages for young playwrights between the ages of 18 and 30.
Around 1994, Eilish Mullen, the late Eilish Mullen, who was running the National Association of Youth Drama at the time, asked me to become involved in a playwriting competition, as in being a judge. So there was herself, myself, and Paddy O'Dwyer, who had founded DYT, were the three judges.
Filmmaker and theatre director Gerard Stenbridge.
I mean, the only rule really was that it had to be a first-time playwright. 120-odd entries. So I was there working my way through my 40 plays. And, you know, I remember at the time actually I had already encountered kind of two or three that I thought were pretty good. And you know, I mean this quite honestly because it's not something I generally regard. I'm not one of these people who thinks, and then the actor came in and wow, he just took us all by storm. You know, generally I find that, you know, finding talent and is a process of thinking about it and working at it and taking a chance on something. But I have to say that in this case, from the title for a start, which I thought, The Aspidistra Code, this sounds interesting, I wonder where this title came from, to, I would say, the first three or four pages, I thought, my God, where has this writer come from? Well, I could tell straight away he came from Dublin. I could tell straight away he was he. But more importantly, as I kind of continue to read it, what struck me about it is that here is an already formed playwright. Here is somebody who understands language, who understands form, pure form. The fact that it was, you know, one of these Dublin stories, you know, set in a house, loan sharks, hairier, you know, fuck me, all that sort of stuff, was actually to me, I realised, and to the writer, you know, somewhat irrelevant to the way in which the structure of the play and the language of the play was how he was expressing its meaning. Just to say the competition, it wasn't like I was, luckily I wasn't saying this is going to win the competition, because what we had formulated in our typical Association of Youth Drama democratic way was that we didn't want one of these competitions where you had a winner and a prize fund. Instead, what we had decided is we will make a very short shortlist of the best potential writers and we would have a weekend of readings. The Abbey had agreed to allow us to use the Peacock stage for that weekend. So because we were going to have, you know, we had in four or five was our marker if we got enough talent. Already, I feel like I knew, well, this is going to be one of them.
The Aspidistra Code is about a family who are hugely in debt to a loan shark. And it's set in the night where the loan shark is going to come around to take payment. They don't have the money. Something bad is going to happen. In terms of where I'm at now, it's a step in that direction, but it's kind of half crime thriller, half kitchen sink drama, if you like. Although it's definitely a comedy. It was having my first taste of that sort of dark criminal world. I knew a lot of characters when I was growing up, but I didn't know anyone who was like literally a criminal. So it was just the idea of making these guys up. Now they're very articulate, they're very funny, they have very odd points of view on the world and all that kind of thing. And I think that sort of came out of necessity because I didn't know anything about this world. So I thought if I can create characters that are kind of original enough in their own world, then that question of, you know, verisimilitude won't be a question.
Well, I directed the first production of From Both Hips, which was Mark's first professionally produced play.
Artistic director of Fishamble Theatre Company, Jim Culleton.
I had seen a reading of The Aspidistra Code. I was actually directing a reading of Lachlan Deegan's first play for the NYD during a season of readings, and Mark also had The Aspidistra Code as part of that season. So Mark told me afterwards that he looked up the Golden Pages for theatre companies and sent copies of From Both Hips around to various theatre companies. So the script arrived on my desk, and I suppose there aren't many times when an unsolicited script arrives into a theatre company's offices and it just blows you away. And I remember reading that script and finding myself laughing and crying at it. I suppose that the mixture of wit and the darkness, and also the way he was playing around with structure. I think at the time he was working in a video shop and he was watching lots of videos and he was influenced by film and video quite a lot, but he was able to play around with structure that you can look at as being filmic, but actually was really, really theatrical as well, because it just played around with how an audience engaged with the play and put the piece, were allowed to be like a detective putting the pieces together. With the first three scenes of From Both Hips, the audience has to sort of gradually piece things together to realise the three scenes are happening simultaneously. So phone calls the characters make and receive are all connected over the course of the three scenes. And I thought that was really, really exciting. So in a way, even though very often a new new play, especially by a new or emerging playwright, might take a year or two to develop through a number of drafts. From Both Hips arrived pretty much intact, and so even though we did do some work with it and help develop it a bit, there really was very little of that work to be done. You know, by the time it arrived, I thought he just had a really fresh, unique kind of voice.
I usually, when I write a play, I don't plot the thing out beforehand. I just start writing, get a couple of characters talking, and see where it goes. And this is what I did with From Both Hips. But what I did, there were three scenes in the first act of that play, pretty much the same length. And the way it worked out was each scene had two characters, but each scene takes place at the same time as the other scene. And we learned this through a series of phone calls. So in each scene, a character makes a phone call and then later on receives a phone call. And these six phone calls in three scenes link every scene, link all the characters, and give us the overall story so far, so that we're completely up to speed. And then we move on to the next part. So I suppose formally, well, for me, I suppose it was inventive. But at the time, it's kind of, oh, yeah, well, what if he phoned him? And what if he phoned him? And then you do sort of get slightly obsessed with shape and kind of go, I have five phone calls here. Maybe I'll have this character receive one just to keep a nice shape to it, you know. And that was how the shape of those first three scenes came about.
Also in 1997, Oro explored the monologue form in a play called Anna's Ankle, which was produced as part of Bedrock Theatre Company's Theatre of Cruelty season. But the real breakthrough came in 1999.
A big reason for writing Howie the Rookie in monologue form was the idea that you could take the story wherever you wanted. If, you know, if the actor is there on stage and he says it happened, then if it's convincing enough, then it happened and we accept that. And that gives you great scope in terms of killing off characters, having as many characters as you like, you know, having the action as spectacular as you like, then moving into more intimate stuff. And you know, it's theatre and it's not. It's somewhere between theatre and stand-up and literature. You know, I don't really see it as exactly theatre, although there is something very powerful about an actor talking directly to an audience. There's a scene at the end where one of the characters gets killed off. Sorry, there's a scene at the end of the first act where one of the characters gets killed off. And then there's a scene at the end of the second act, near the end of the play, where several characters get killed in a similar manner. That was definitely me beginning to tap into the idea of the unpredictability of life and the violence that can happen to us out of the blue. So the idea that somebody is the hero doesn't mean that they're going to save the day or that they're going to be triumphant at the end. Or it doesn't mean that they're not going to be cut down just before the end. And that's, I found that was something you could do in a monologue or in theatre that you definitely weren't really allowed to do in well, I suppose, more mainstream cinema, which is play with that kind of expectation. But then again, it's not really playing with expectations. It's genuinely the idea that at any time any of us can, you know, be the victim of a vicious crime or be knocked down or catch a fatal disease or whatever. And we're kind of so brittle and so fragile that way. And the fact that characters in a story are, you know, are just as susceptible to fate and bad luck as the rest of us are.
I'd read From Both Hips and I liked it very much, the style and the writing, and thought about at one stage of possibly doing it at The Bush.
Former artistic director of The Bush, Mike Bradwell.
But it sort of got passed. But I was interested in him. Sometime later, a play came through the post called Howie the Rookie. And I have to say it's one of the only plays that has ever arrived from The Bush where we didn't change a word of it before we started rehearsing. It came absolutely fully formed. And it was remarkable. A remarkable piece of storytelling. The thing about Howie the Rookie is it's two interconnecting monologues, which makes it a duologue, so you don't have to get into all the thing about monologues not being theatre. But at the same time, you know, I really don't buy that argument. I mean, you know, you don't go to see a string quartet and moan it's not an orchestra. Mark had a very strong idea about how he wanted it said and how he wanted it done, because he heard it in his head. But getting what was in Mark's head into the head of the actors was a different proposition, really. But we found two brilliant actors in Aidan Kelly and Carl Shields. And we came up with the idea that what we were doing was like stand-up comedy, only stand-up drama. And we came up with the idea that what the play was probably like was if you'd been to see a film and your mates hadn't, and you went back to the pub and you said, I've seen this great film, and you tried to describe The Matrix. Now, the only way you could describe The Matrix to your mates was having seen The Matrix. So what we did was we evolved this idea of storyboarding, to an extent, the entire play. So when Carl and Aidan were talking about what they were seeing, we had worked out what the shot was that they had seen. To that end, of course, when they talked about the other characters, it was quite important that they were talking about the same people. So we cast every other part in the play. We said, who will play that part? So when each of the actors were talking about, say, Pudding Boy, White Pudding Boy, they were both thinking of the same person who would play it in the movie. So the whole thing was basically playing a movie in your head and then telling it to the audience. And I think that was quite a unique way of going about things.
Made in China, which was produced at the Peacock Theatre in 2001, it's a gangster play, really, about some fairly low-level gangsters. I moved back from the monologue form back to a more traditional form. The play is told in two acts, one scene in each act. But I sort of wanted to continue exploring that slightly invented world that I'd done in Howie the Rookie in a more traditional staging style. I had written a huge martial arts battle between the three characters at the end. I'd written it quite specifically, actually. And I wanted the play to build up. The story tells of lots of sort of over-the-top, Howie the Rookie-esque style sequences that happen off stage, and I kind of thought it would be slightly betraying to only have that sort of action happen off stage. So to let the thing build to a kind of a huge spectacular battle. The world of the play is Dublin, but it's not exactly Dublin. It's my version of Dublin. So the characters speak in a very specific way that's not realistic or not naturalistic in any way. The settings, there's a Chinatown in this Dublin, which there wasn't at the time. There kind of is now, but there wasn't at the time. At the time it was written, and sort of things like that, where there were, you know, rogue cops who went around beating up people at whim. It was just creating a sort of a fictionalized version of where we live, and using the sort of hyper real and almost cartoonish elements this was my intention anyway, to sort of make the violence a little bit more palatable, because it wasn't realism. It wasn't trying to give us a documentary look at violence and the effects of violence. And I suppose in a way it was, I mean, I feel any new play is a step forward, but it was definitely a step back in terms of indulging my inner teen, you know, and having all the sex talk and all the dirty language and all the attempted rapes and beatings and all that kind of stuff, and just kind of throwing everything in there and in a cartoonish way.
The first piece of work that I came across by Mark was Howie the Rookie, which I saw at the Bush.
Film and theatre director John Crowley.
It was already quite a celebrated piece by then, but for some reason I hadn't seen it. And so I saw it towards the end of its run, and I was completely blown away when I saw it. And I had been approached a little earlier by Neil Jordan, who had said, you know, if you wanted to make a film, that he would produce it for me and to keep my eye out for a writer that I might like to work with. And after seeing Howie the Rookie, I tracked Mark down. At first, he was quite reluctant to embrace the idea of working on a screenplay. I think he had a couple of false starts with it. 3-4 months later, I was doing a rehearsed reading of a play by Mark called Made in China at the National Theatre Studio here in London, and asked him what else he had been up to in the meantime, and he said that he had written this thing, as he said, and didn't want to have a look at it. And that turned out to be the first draft of Intermission. What I found astonishing about the screenplay was, apart from his confidence, that you couldn't second guess it, you know, right from that very first scene where ultimately it was Colin Farrell in the movie smacked the waitress. You know, from that point on, all bets were off in this film, and you just knew that whatever you thought the film was going to be, it simply was going to refuse to fulfil that sort of possibility. What was astonishing was just how funny it was, and also the impression that I got from reading that first draft was the sheer energy that was coming off the script was mind-boggling. It was electric, and that's what we really tried to capture in the finished film.
Crestfall was produced by the Gate Theatre in 2003, and it was directed by Gary Hines.
Actress Eileen Walsh.
And it was three monologues based on three women's life over a weekend, really, in a small town. The other two women were Marie Mullen and Aisling O'Sullivan. And all three characters were interlinked in some sort of way. Basically, as Aisling's monologue would finish, Marie Mullen's monologue would start, and same, hers would dip and then mine would come up again. And so the story was brought through in an arc by the three of us. Basically, my character, Tilly McQuarrie, was a young prostitute. She desperately wanted a baby and had been forced into an abortion beforehand, which then made her want the baby more. So the monologue is for her is about her searching for a baby and or a pregnancy or whatever, some hope from that. And the whole thing peaks with a massive shootout in a bar, and she's left cowering for her life in general, and finds a baby that's been left there, and so she's the only one to kind of care for this baby.
Crestfall was, I suppose, my most difficult play. Not in the sense that it was difficult to write, but it's definitely my darkest play. I made a very deliberate choice to remove any elements of humour, and it's a new creation, which was a fictional town in Ireland in which any emotional communication or transaction or any social communication or transaction is defined by violence, I suppose, and sex and the baser elements of our nature. And the idea that if you're a normal person living in a town like this, where 99% of the people there are incredibly primitive in how they interact, what would come of that? So I also wanted to write a play for women, because the last two plays I'd written before that were completely male cast. So and I thought that was a nice idea as well, in terms of dealing with violence on a very in your face level, to have it kind of told through the eyes of three women. The form of the play is three monologues. I went back to the monologues for this one. It was like Howie the Rookie. One actor comes on and then leaves the stage, never to return. Then the next actor, then the next actor. Unlike Howie the Rookie, all three stories sort of happen in the same time frame. So each story is affecting other stories, and the last story will revert back to the first, and they kind of dovetail and they do all those kind of things.
Terminus was just this year, in 2007, for the Peacock Theatre, and written and directed by Mark O'Rowe. There was three characters, A, B and C. A was Andrea Irvine, I was B, and Aidan Kelly was C. And basically, it was monologues, just like Crestfall. But there was a whole different slant in that, as kind of muscular and aggressive as Crestfall was, this became even more masculine, really, with its kind of very kind of strong street slang and rhymes, very much like Eminem or like a kind of intenseful rapping, really, which was great for learning, but a nightmare for stage fright, because if you forget, then you're on your own out there, and it very much felt on your own, as opposed to Crestfall and the kind of comfort of each other. This one was very different in that we didn't connect. We just had to let each other's stories happen and rise and fall, and that was it. And it was very lonely out there, which is good, because the Terminus itself is about where these characters end up. And my character says about us all being in this terminus at one point, when she is, without ruining it, she has died, and she's in the kind of limbo land of heaven, hell, or come back to life, or wherever. And she's just lingering in the water, just wondering what this terminus is like. And each of the characters get those. But his writing had kind of made this massive leap, that you could see Crestfall and Howie the Rookie, and you know that they were all heading in that direction of culminating to be Terminus.
This was the first play I directed. It was just the desire to take something from its conception right through to the very, very end. And in a weird way, you don't, because as a director, you only take it to a certain point, and then the actors take it much further again. So you do actually have to break it off with the play at a particular time, you know. But it was as far as I could go in terms of being the creator. I mean, it was a fantastic experience, terrifying, you know. I mean, but I felt that I'd written a good enough play and told a good enough story that, as badly as it could have been done, that would have been, you know, the scaffolding to hold it up and make sure that it was at least reasonable, you know. But the best thing I ever did was, I suppose, was hired such a fantastic cast, you know, because you do realise when you're directing actors how theatre sort of feels very much more an actor's game than a director's or a writer's game. You know what I mean? They make the thing live in such a way that you can never read the play again without hearing their voices. You know, that becomes, like, even in the author's mind, the way it was written. But it wasn't the way it was written. You know, it wasn't the way you wrote it when you first heard it. But it's what it becomes, and for the better. For me, from the beginning, it was always about language. Even in those early days trying to imitate Mammoth or Pinter or any of those guys, it was always the confidence to go further with the play was always inspired by writing a few lines and reading back over them and go, that's really good writing. You know, that reads really well. I really like that. And I suppose pushing wherever it is I'm going with language, that's always been the fuel for me, the thing that pushed me on. I mean, there's always story, situation, character, themes, whatever. But for me, to actually get me in front of the desk, you know, from day to day, it was always about the satisfaction of working with and pushing the language.
The playwright in profile was Marco Rowe. The contributors were Mike Bradwell, John Crowley, Jim Colleton, Gerard Stenbridge, and Eileen Walsh. The programme was compiled and presented by Sean Rocks, and the producer was Kevin Reynolds.